The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis with the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is titled, The Value of Voodoo. While it's viewed as a taboo tradition in popular culture, New Orleans residents who practice the West African religion say it's more about healing than hexes. Second lines are a signature of New Orleans culture, presented for various occasions, including funerals. But there's an often overlooked connection between the celebratory procession that precedes a burial, marked by dancing as a brass band plays a hymn known as a dirge, and one of the world's most misunderstood religions. That's voodoo in plain sight, says Cinnamon Black, a tour guide at the New Orleans Historic Voodoo Museum. The spirituality and music move people. It takes you to another level, physically and mentally. Black is what's known as a voodoo ni, a person who, like a priestess, was trained in this religious practice. Voodoo originated in the West African country of Benin and later took shape in Haiti during the transatlantic slave trade. Black was initiated to it in the Crescent City. It's a way of life in the city of New Orleans, she says. It's in the food, the music, and the culture. The complexities of voodoo date back as far as its most famous figure, Marie Laveau. Born in 1801, Laveau was a free Louisiana Creole healer and herbalist who was also a practitioner of root work, or hoodoo, a form of spiritual folk magic. She offered services in her home and in New Orleans' famous Congo Square, where enslaved and free individuals from West Africa and the Caribbean colonies of Martinique and Saint Dominique, now known as Haiti, were allowed to gather, dance, and play drums on Sundays. She had clients coming from all over the country for spiritual readings and healing practices. So there was a commercial aspect of voodoo that in the 19th century made it an integral part of New Orleans culture, says Richard Turner, PhD, professor of African American religious history at the University of Iowa. The commercialization of voodoo today is a part of the stereotyping of the religion. It's related to the tourist industry. This idea that voodoo is about sticking pins in dolls and putting curses on people when it's actually a healing religious tradition. The mischaracterization of voodoo, which is rooted in the worship of various deities and a connection to the ancestors and spirits of the dead, dates back to the late 1700s. Part of the reason that voodoo is demonized is because it was the religious tradition that animated the Haitian Revolution, Turner explains, which defeated Napoleon's armies and forced the French plantation owners to flee to New Orleans. Haiti became the first black republic in the Western Hemisphere that was ruled by ex-slaves, and it was an example that the United States didn't want replicated. When a series of municipal laws were subsequently passed in the 1800s limiting the ability of slaves to gather, voodoo became an underground religion shrouded in mysticism, rather other than the empowering spiritual practice it was designed to be. Voodoo means to do and to apply, explains Priestess Miriam, who established the Voodoo Spiritual Temple in 1990 with her late husband, Priest Oswan Shamani. What people think of as voodoo practice now is superficial. They could never understand the deeper emotional transformation those people in Haiti went through to put together a perfect plan and rise up and carry it out. This is at the core of the work of Black. Priestess Miriam and other practitioners like Sin Elias, owner of the Hoodoo Shop Crescent Center Conjure. What these practices teach us: when you're faced with opposition for you or your family, you need to take action. But at the end of the day, it's for the higher good, Elias says. It can take many forms, putting red brick dust at your door to bring prosperity, using oils or spell bags known as gris-gris to manifest an intention, or seeking out a priest or priestess for a spiritual consultation, as you would see a counselor for guidance. We do readings, we believe in meditation, we believe in prayer, and we believe that we have a sixth sense and an ability to speak to something higher than ourselves, and that we can receive messages, Elias explains. Though lingering misconceptions about the dark nature of voodoo still lead to some unsavory requests, people always call me when they are mad at somebody and want to know how to get rid of them without going to jail, Black jokes. Most are seeking answers. People bring their secrets through your door to see how you can help them through their crisis, says Priestess Miriam. It was Voodoo Priestess who helped Turner process his mother's transition when she fell into a coma in the summer of 1997. She gave me a reading. She prayed in every corner of my house with holy incenses from the Bible. And I created an ancestral altar in my house for my mother, because voodoo practitioners very much believe in respecting your elders and that your ancestors have an impact on your luck in life, he says. I found that to be very moving at a time that I was grieving. Though Turner didn't ultimately remain a practitioner, his brief personal encounter demonstrates a truth that Black hopes to relay about the ancient religion, which still sparks widespread curiosity. Voodoo, you don't pick it, Black says. It picks you. The next article is titled, Nice Guys Finish First. New Orleans restaurateur Larry Morrow is proof that Southern hospitality is a winning business strategy. Under the pale red glow of a neon sign that reads, I love you to the sun and back, Larry Morrow wears a coy smile. I can read the pride in his eyes as he answers my questions while a photographer snaps away, capturing Morrow's image as he stands in the physical manifestation of his greatest loves, family, food, and business. We're at Sun Chung, his latest eatery, nestled in the heart of New Orleans French Quarter. It serves Korean and Cajun-inspired cuisine, a nod to the two cultures that shaped him. Morrow opened the restaurant as a surprise gift to his grandmother, for whom he named the business. She's a petite but mighty force who hails from Korea and set down roots in New Orleans. Sun Chong had followed the love of her life, a handsome 6'1" black man, to the United States after they met while he fought in the Korean War. Morrow's Asian Fusion Haunt opened in 2023, and as with his other establishments, Treehouse Nightclub and Morrow's Restaurant, the patronage has been enthusiastic. "We get busy and people really love it here. I do too," one server tells me over a plate of gumbo dumplings, which the restaurateur and I devour in a leisurely way about an hour before the dining room opens for the day. In that time before customers arrive, we are able to savor the perfect combination of Cajun soup encased in a steamed and lightly flash fried dough. Without Sun Chong's loyal crowd, it gives me the opportunity to take in the intricate details of the restaurant's decor. Blooming hibiscus flowers adorn the walls. The dark and bright colors meet, creating a harmony of stern and soft. It has Morrow all over it. One of the most eye-catching parts is a hand-drawn yong, a dragon from Korean folklore, whose sleek body winds around the eatery's high beams up to the dark painted ceiling. Its powerful countenance hovers above, looking over Sun Chong in a protective stance. This attractive design choice is a pivotal part of Morrow's story. "You're the dragon of the family," Morrow recalls his grandmother telling him. "You're the one that flies high." Morrow is indeed a hustler. "I've always been attracted to winning," he admits. In his teens, he began promoting nightlife events around NOLA. At age 20, he leveraged his charisma and business savvy to begin putting on his own. His first ever netted around $11,000. He then went on to launch an event production company that drew in such big names as Mary J. Blige, Drake, and Floyd Mayweather. In a little over a decade, Morrow has gained a reputation in celebrity circles as the go-to person to see when you're in New Orleans. "I treat people the way I would want to be treated," he says simply in his syrupy drawl. "Yeah, I'm a nice guy. I know how to deal with people, and this industry has taught me that you have to deal with a lot of egos constantly. Over time, I've learned to pay attention to people's wants, and I try to fulfill them, to anticipate them. I learned that early on." Raised by a single mother and his grandmother, two women who led with love, without forsaking discipline and strength, Morrow's foundation was firm. "My mom played the mother and father figures in my life," he explains. "It helped me grow into the man that I am and gain a deeper understanding of what other people really think and feel. The women ultimately taught him to be a servant leader." Public figures have remarked on his keen attention to customer service, which extends to celebrities and everyday citizens alike. He has a seemingly omniscient-like approach to his businesses. "If I pop up and the music is a decibel too loud or a napkin is out of place, I can sense it," he says. "This is notable since we're in a time when the discourse around black-owned businesses treating customers poorly has reached a fever pitch. Not so in Moreau's establishments, which, not surprisingly, have become marquee venues for Black nightlife in NOLA. Just take a look at the social media reviews. I am kind, but when it comes to business, I don't play, Moreau clarifies. The next article is titled Media Mavericks. In this column, Essence Ventures CEO and President Caroline Wanga explores Black women as chief executive officers of home, culture, and community, and focuses on helping every Black woman recognize the chief that already exists within her by introducing the ones who live among us. Rashida Jones is a trailblazing media executive and currently serves as the president of MSNBC, a role she assumed in February 2021. She's the first Black woman to lead a major cable news network, a significant milestone in the industry. With a background in journalism and a keen eye for innovative content, Jones has been instrumental in shaping the network's programming and editorial direction. Under her leadership, MSNBC has continued to thrive, balancing hard-hitting news coverage with insightful political analysis. Caroline Wanga asked the question, "So, with that, ma'am, who is Rashida Jones?" Rashida Jones responded, "Who is Rashida Jones? Okay, I'm a mom, I'm a wife, I'm a woman, I'm a Black woman, I am a Black woman who has benefited from a lot of other Black women and women leaders in general coming ahead of me. I am someone who cares about the future. I want to make my mark on the future. I want to have an impact. That's who I am." Caroline asks the next question, "How did you end up in this place? How did you get here?" Jones answered, "So I worked my butt off. Number one, I worked my butt off. You know, I always knew I wanted to be a journalist. I knew from third grade when I was making little newspapers in my neighborhood." Caroline responded, "I'm sorry, third grade?" Jones said, "I knew I wanted to be a journalist. So I remember my sister and my two neighbors, we put together a neighborhood newspaper and we wrote it ourselves. This, remember, is before computers and all this other stuff. And we would write it out and go hand it out to our neighbors. Of course, I was an editor because I had to tell them exactly how to make sure it was all correct. And I liked the idea of being able to talk to people. I liked the idea of being able to tell stories. So I was kind of on that path my entire life. Once I realized there was a job where you can marry journalism and being in charge, I was like, sign me up." Caroline asks the next question, "Tell us a little bit about that journey. So you graduate from Hampton University, an HBCU in Hampton, Virginia. You have this focus. What's the first place you start to work?" Jones responded, "It was interesting. I started part-time at a local TV station, a CBS affiliate in Norfolk, Virginia. And the summer before my senior year, I got promoted to be a full-time producer. At the time, I had 1 year left of school. And I did not want to be in school longer than 1 year. So I kept the same courses that I had planned to take while I was working overnight. I would go to work at 10 p.m. and I would leave at 7 or 8 a.m. then take a nap and go to class. I was balancing two things. Caroline asked the next question. In Virginia, you are also a showrunner. Will you tell people what a showrunner is? Jones responded, I was in charge of everything. What stories do people go out on? What stories are on the show? Writing the show, you know, managing the minute by minute aspects of the show. I am weeks into this, and then 9/11 happens, and I am a senior in college. I think I just turned 21, and I'm in the middle of this big news story. And so, because I was working so much, there was a period when it clicked from being a job to being a public service. We have to tell the stories of the people affected. The event itself didn't happen in Virginia, but I was in a military town where we had the Navy. We had all of our soldiers and all of our sailors coming up to this area and then going into the Middle East. We were deep into coverage, and there was a point where I had to take a few weeks off from school because I was in the newsroom so much. I was sleeping in an edit booth because we were doing around-the-clock coverage. There was a three-week period where I spent every minute that I could in the newsroom. Really, this story was so consequential for the country. In some ways, I was learning on the job while being able to contribute to something that matters. Caroline responded, one of the nation's biggest tragedies takes place while you're working in the news. Can we just talk about Rashida at that moment? Rashida answered, there have been so many instances where you're in the moment and you don't have time to think about anything but delivering, right? And that's when it transitions from a job to a public service. I knew I had to be there. The role of a journalist was to tell the stories and, as we always say, write the first draft of history. So, in some ways, it allowed me to write the first draft of history. By definition, terrorism is so to incite fear. And so we were fearful. We were afraid. We didn't know how long the country was going to feel like this. But I think that just added to the sense of purpose and the sense of mission that I had in real time. And it just further cemented for me the sense of purpose that I would have going forward. Early on, especially when you're starting out, you don't make a lot of money. You don't have a lot of resources. There were times where I worked a part-time job and also worked in a newsroom, but I never thought twice about what I was doing because I had the sense of purpose, the sense of mission. I knew this is what I was meant to do. Caroline questioned, how old were you? Rashida responded, let's see, I think I was 23 when I left that job, so I had been there for 4 years or so, and I knew I wanted to do something different. I felt like I checked every box that I needed at the station. I'd produced on every show, and I was the lead producer. I was the 11 o'clock producer, which was one of the premium roles, but I also kind of picked up these other responsibilities. I was the person, if there was a project that was in play, I raised my hand. If there was a new initiative, I raised my hand. When I left, I was the 11 o'clock producer, but I was also in charge of weather coverage. We had a hurricane season that was really impactful, and I got to drive all that stuff. And so that also made me say, okay, how do I move forward with this unusual combination of responsibilities that I have? And I looked at a map and thought, where do I want to live? I blacked out the West Coast because it was too far. I mean, we still had to get home for Thanksgiving. My children were born in Atlanta, and my life, you know, was developing. But then I remember very vividly during the first Obama inauguration, sitting on the couch, very, very pregnant with my daughter. I remember saying, I want to get back in a traditional newsroom. I want to get back into covering politics and telling stories and all of those things. And I remember saying it out loud, sitting there by myself, because I was watching coverage all day, because I was like in it. And I said, by the next election, I want to be in a newsroom. Caroline said, how has intuition played a role on that journey for you? Jones responded, I think for some of my movements, it has been a guide. Sometimes it's just that it could be reinforcing the external, or it could be taking a leap that you never even thought about. But I think over time, you learn to trust that intuition. I have no problem talking to myself. We have conversations with each other, and sometimes she knows what I am not thinking, and vice versa. But I think sometimes the things you say inside may be bolder and bigger than the things you may say out loud. And so I think for me, in those moments, even when I was moving to Atlanta, I was very happy in the job that I was in, but I knew it was like time to take the next step. Sometimes there's no specific trigger, no specific reason. You just know that it's time to think differently and do something differently. Sometimes the inner voice might be telling you to stay put or wait. I don't know why you're waiting. I don't know what you are waiting for, but wait. And I think that comes from, you know, whatever higher being you believe in. Sometimes I feel like when I hear the things in my voice and I don't know why or where it's coming from, but it's not coming from me. Someone somewhere is telling me that I just need to listen to that voice. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Ava Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.